Welcome to the Aussie Expat Podcast, brought to you by Atlas Wealth Management. This podcast is for Aussie expats living and working overseas who want to learn more about managing their finances and making the most of their time away as an Australian expat. Atlas Wealth Management is a multi-award winning advisory and is the leading provider of Australian expat financial advice and planning services to Australian expats in over 18 countries. And here is your host, Managing Director of Atlas Wealth Management, Brett Evans.
So let's run through tonight what pretty much isn't the most exciting nights for most people out there. For us, we always love to look at the devil in the detail. And there's a couple of key things here that we'll run through and talk about some of the key points that were raised in last night's federal budget. So just running through a couple of housekeeping issues. Here's the fine print. Wouldn't be a financial advisor if we didn't have to, you know, pretty much provide a whole page of disclaimers. Boiling it down, essentially it means that it's general information only. Obviously, if any of this does pertain to you, please do not take this information as personal advice, and please do seek professional advice on what the ramifications may be. Just running through, who is Atlas Wealth Management? We're the first and only Australian financial services firm to specialise in providing financial advice to Australian expats. We currently have the privilege of looking after clients in over 24 countries, so everywhere from Moldova to Malaysia and United States, UK and everywhere in between. So we've got some pretty amazing clients, and you know, we're just privileged that we're able to provide them with what we consider to be, you know, the best advice in the industry. We've been nominated as a finalist as well as winning in a number of domestic and international awards for the work we've been doing. We certainly don't do this work for the accolades, but it's always nice to be recognised for the effort we put into there. Who am I? I'm the founder and managing director of Atlas Wealth Management. 2016, I won the Innovator of the Year Award for Financial Advice, and in 2017, Investment Advisor of the Year by IFA Magazine for the role we've been handling in providing expat financial advice. We've had the pleasure of working with Forbes, the Australian Financial Review, Sky Business News, and many other media publications. We do enjoy working with these franchises because it enables us to get a greater voice. As you'd imagine, the Australian diaspora is spread over many, many countries, and it's by working with media partners we're able to get the message out there. And you know, the government doesn't do a very good job in communicating a lot of those changes to expats. So we sort of take it upon ourselves to get out there and beat the chest and try and get the information out there. In doing so, what we'll often do is, you know, try and get up and get on the front foot like we are tonight to broadcast that information. I'll just quickly run through a quick summary of the budget on what we saw as some of the key aspects of it. Look, it's a budget to us that is preparing the government for a upcoming federal election. Or depending on who you believe, it may be the last budget before the next federal election is being called. And as you can see by a lot of the press, if you're looking at the Australian media, it's pretty much centred around tax cuts to low to middle income earners. So obviously the bulk of the voting populace. But also too, you know, we find that there's a couple of gaps in the financials there that, to me, I think the government's keeping their powder dry so that when they do announce going to a federal election, they do have a bit of firepower and they can start to release some more detailed policy. Unfortunately, we haven't seen things that we like to see in line with things like infrastructure spending and some of those big ticket items, but I dare hazard a guess that that'll be coming out in the in the politicking that occurs in the build-up to the federal election. So the budget was a budget that pretty much centred around a higher receivables that the government's received over the last 12 months. We have seen a resurgence in the resource sector, so their tax receipts are a lot higher than originally expected, and certainly that what was forecast in the 2017 federal budget. So that's a good win for the government. If we can keep on this path, we're actually looking at returning to a surplus in the next year and a half. So, you know, all depending on which side of politics you're on, you know, you can, twist it either way. But at the end of the day, to us, it's a fair budget. It's nothing too fantastic. The good news for expats is for once, and that means since 2012, Australian expats have not been targeted in any way, shape or form. So that's been a sigh of relief for a lot of expats, because quite often what we see with, you know, these things is, you know, specific carve-outs like we saw last year with the main residence exemption, and in previous years regarding the removal of the 50% capital gains tax-free capital gains threshold for non-resident property investors. So we'll run through now some of the key elements. Obviously, we've broken these down into sections. So the first one, we'll be talking about a bit of tax. Second one, we'll be talking about superannuation. And the last one will be investments. So in the tax summary, if you know, you're online and you're not planning on returning to Australia in the next 6 years, then you can pretty much grab a cup of coffee. But you know, it gives you a pretty good idea of how the tax scales and landscape is going to change in Australia. We've itemised out there a number of different ways, but I often find that it's easy to explain these sort of concepts in a table. So I'll just go across to the next one there. So on the left-hand column, we've currently got the latest thresholds. So that shouldn't be a surprise to anyone there, and the representative tax rates for each one of those thresholds. What I've done is I've highlighted in yellow where the changes are occurring, and obviously going through running the different tax years on when those changes are I guess recommended to occur. Bearing in mind, all the announcements last night aren't law yet. They do have to pass through government, so this isn't set in stone. Obviously, there'll be a lot of banter and argy-bargy from both sides of the house, but it's a good rule of thumb to say, you know, work on this basis and keep your eyes peeled for latest updates. So from the 1st of July, what we're going to see is a change in the third threshold. That's going from 37,000 up to 90,000. Up at the moment, it's up to 87,000. And the main reason for that is the federal government's always been concerned about what we call bracket creep. And bracket creep is when you are receiving any sort of pay increases, and in actual fact that that pay increase does not have the desired effect, because it, all it does is puts you into the next tax bracket, you pay more tax, and your take home is actually less. So this whole latest change that the government's announced pretty much centres around bracket creep, and it's a word you'll probably see thrown around in quite a lot of the press. So from 1 July this year, the top of the third tier in that threshold will be rising to 90,000, and then no further changes after that. And then we jump forward to the 1st of July 2022, and this is when the changes start to get quite significant. So we go from, in the second level, instead of 37,000, we go up to 41,000 in terms of the top threshold in the second tier. And then this is where we see quite a lot of changes. So in the third tier, we're now going from 41,000 to 120,000. So virtually what it means is if you're earning $120,000 a year, you're in the 32.5% tax bracket, as opposed to right now, where if you're earning $120,000 a year, you're in the 37% tax bracket. So I think it's fair to say that $120,000, while still is a reasonable amount of money, isn't as large a income as it was, say, 10 or 20 years ago. And a lot more of the voting public are now starting to fit into this 41 to 120,000 range. Obviously, the next tier goes up from there. So now we, instead of saying 87,000 to 180,000, we're now going from 120,000 to 180,000. So you now need to earn over $120,000 to fall into the 37% tax bracket. And then going forward into 1 July 2024, and this is obviously on the premise that the Liberal and National parties are still elected, then we actually see the total removal of the 37% tax bracket. So the way it's going to work is up to $18,200, you won't pay any tax. That's at the tax-free threshold. From 18,201 up to 41,000, you'll still pay your 19%. But then from 41,000 up to $200,000, you'll only pay 32.5%. So what we see here is the removal of that $87,000 to $180,000 bracket that we're currently experiencing right now. And then once you go over $200,000, you'll be into the 45% range. So to us, you know, I think there's, we always talk about, you know, people having an incentive to work. That actually removes the bracket creep argument completely. And by that, you'd have to say that you know, it's a good win for a lot of the mum and dads out there who are, you know, the bulk of the people in that tax bracket. So the next thing we'll run through now is talking about the super changes, and there are quite a number of changes. So they will affect different people at different times, and we'll run through that summary right now. So there's a number of changes, and these will affect people who are both expats staying overseas and also those looking to return to Australia. So the three key changes that we see affecting expats is the work test exemption for recent retirees, the capping passive fees, banning exit fees, and reuniting inactive accounts, and changes to default super arrangements for the below the age of 25 with small balances. So we'll run through the work tax exemption first. This one kicks in on the 1st of July 2019, and essentially it's for clients aged between 65 and 74 who have recently ceased work and have super balances below $300,000. Quite often we find, especially for those expats who've been overseas for a longer period of time, they may have accumulated wealth outside of super and especially overseas. So what we often find is, even though your net worth may be reasonable overseas, your actual net worth in Australia before repatriation back to Australia, if you are going to retire back here, is quite low. So this is actually quite a good incentive for those expats who are returning, who certainly hung up the boots, they do not meet the works test, and their balance is below 300, and they need to have that opportunity to top up their super where possible. So from the 1st of July, the government intends to reduce or introduce an exemption from the works test. This is only for the first year that the retiree does not meet the works test requirements. What that essentially means is, if you are 65, 60, 67, 68, still working, still meeting the works test, then you can still contribute up to $100,000 by way of a non-concessional contribution. But let's say, for example, you said, okay, time to hang up the boots, we're done, then you don't meet the works test. However, for that 1 year only, you're able to contribute one last lot of $100,000 into your super fund by way of a non-concessional contribution. The caveat is, obviously, your balance has to be below $300,000. So it's something that, you know, requires prior planning. And we've seen a gradual reduction in the non-concessional contribution limits. Last year was $180,000. This year it's $100,000. It's very difficult to determine whether it's going to keep going down. We hope not. You know, there should be an incentive for expats to contribute to their super and obviously not provide a burden on the Australian federal government by way of a age pension. The next one, and I think this is probably the one that we get the most excited about, is the capping of fees and lost accounts. Once again, this kicks in on the 1st of July 2019, and there's probably three key points here that we need to run through. So obviously, it's clients with super balances below 6,000, and obviously clients seeking to exit funds. So with the $6,000 balance, it sounds low, but I'll explain in a minute why a lot of people do maintain low balance super funds. So the government's announced a 3% annual cap on passive fees charged by super funds on accounts with balances below 6,000. Time and time again at Atlas, when we're reviewing super accounts, it's pretty horrendous, some of the fees we see that get charged on clients' accounts, and we certainly embrace this and, you know, welcome the government to implement this change. The government's also announced a ban on exit fees on all super accounts. So what that means is, all depending on what funds you're in, and this is why it's important to read the fine print when you look at your own super fund, sometimes they will charge you a percentage-based fee or a dollar-based fee if you were to choose to leave that fund, which quite often can provide a disincentive to leave that fund, even though you may be going to a fund that is better in your interest. Right now, we're working on a case with a couple of people where we've seen exit fees as high as 3%. And you can imagine, if you're looking at balances of $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, we're talking about a sizable fee here being charged, not for any benefit of the client, just because obviously the fund doesn't want to lose that money. So they're taking the money on the way out. Now, in addition to this, the government's also announced that all inactive accounts with balances below 6,000 will be required to be transferred to the ATO. And then the ATO is going to use its data matching process in an attempt to reunite these inactive accounts with the members' active accounts. So this is fantastic news for expats, because quite often when we're doing reviews for clients, you may have three, four, five, we've seen as high as 9 super funds. And that's for those who you've kept track of. Time and time again, we're seeing expats who have not maintained or kept track of where super fund is in which fund. And what's actually happened is, with those funds, they're essentially lost, because the client doesn't know which fund it was, what their member number was. We have no way of tracking down who that fund is until it pops out on the other side, when it gets passed back to the ATO and it is classified as lost super. So what we look at is, you know, once it goes to Lost Super, there can be a time delay in getting there. But once it hits Lost Super, unless you know to go to Lost Super to look at those accounts, it can still sit there with the ATO and do nothing. So by announcing this, what the federal government's talking about is if they do find balances that are, you know, classified as Lost Super and they see on your records that you currently have an active super fund account, then they'll just automatically transfer that balance into your active account. So to us, that's a great result, and we certainly like to see the government continue with that. Just to run through a quick issue with that $6,000 balance, why people have low balances. Quite often what we find is when you become an expat, accruing or getting policies with respect to life and TPD insurance and life insurance and risk insurance is very difficult. And when we're doing reviews on clients, and if they have been overseas for an extended period of time, or they do work in an environment that none of the insurers like to provide coverage, quite often we can default and rely upon the insurance that is inside of your super, as long as the super trustee and the insurer confirm in writing to us that the insurance is valid for a non-resident. So that's the first thing. Once we get that confirmation, then what we do is we keep a low balance just to provide funding for that insurance policy until we can try and secure a alternative solution. But sometimes that's not the case. So what we do is we're better off having some cover, which is better than none. So we'll leave a small balance. Now, that's probably the only time you'll actually actively and purposely keep a small balance in your super fund. So this is a very key issue for us and something we've got to watch very closely for our clients, and something I encourage all expats to keep an eye on as well too, because what they're saying is if your fund goes below $6,000, then they may classify it as an inactive account. So it's important to actively monitor those accounts, make sure there's some sort of activity, and that activity can be either way of a member contribution, an employer contribution, or a rollover. So there needs to be some sort of activity on that account, otherwise it'll be classified as lost. This default insurance announcement that was also announced sort of comes into as well what we're talking before with respect to the $6,000 cap. Now, what this means is insurance inside of a super fund can drop off. And what the what Canberra's concerned about is people may have low balances and they have insurance inside of a super account that they're not even aware of, but they're definitely paying for it. So what they're saying here is you are going to have to opt in if your balance is below $6,000 and or below the age of 25 for the insurance to maintain or remain current inside of that account. So essentially what they mean is if there's been no contributions in 13 months and no activity in that account, then more than likely they will turn off that insurance and also pass that super fund to the ATO. There's going to be a 14-month transition window for members to decide whether to opt in to maintain the insurance. Obviously, you know, we're not happy about that because it means we're going to have to talk to every single one of our clients and remind them to make sure that that balance is updated. So it's a bit more work on the administration side, but obviously the importance of retaining that insurance can't be stressed enough. From 1 July 2019, the clients will be required to opt in, and if you don't, then that insurance will be turned off. Obviously, it's going to be up to your individual circumstances whether you retain that insurance or turn it off. Obviously, it depends on what sort of accounts you're running, and definitely speak to your advisor on the pros and cons of which accounts to use there. So now we're going to run through on in the investment side, and there's a couple of key changes here which are both in favour of expats. So one's in favour, one's against, but we'll run through that shortly. So running through here, as of the 1st of January 2019, clients with managed investments in Australia will get access to the reduced withholding tax rate if you're a resident of one of 56 new jurisdictions that have been added to the list with Australia. So currently the way that the non-resident withholding tax works is if you are a resident of a country that has a double taxation agreement with Australia, like UK, Singapore, United States, then 15% will be deducted from that income and 85% will be remitted back to you. If you reside in a country that does not have a double taxation agreement with Australia, like the United Arab Emirates or Hong Kong, for example, then 30% will be deducted from the income and 70% will be remitted back to you. So that's what we call taxed at source. So what it means is if you have an investment with a fund manager or investment held through a share registry, they'll tax it on your behalf and then they'll provide that money straight to the ATO. You don't have to actually provide any payment to the ATO on that. So it's one of the benefits that a lot of expats use. Obviously, we use that for a lot of our clients in the investment accounts. And by using those sort of facilities, obviously, we're able to provide a on-the-ground solution for offshore clients, but also to we can also utilize other benefits like franking credits and certain key topics that certainly are very important when it comes to what to do with your money. Do you remit it back to Australia? Do you hold it offshore? And where you can get those commensurate returns. So we'll be presenting a report in the next couple of days which goes into more detail on these benefits and also as well as listing out those countries. The best way, if you are not a client, to get access to that report is follow us on Facebook because we'll be publishing that through Facebook. It's www.facebook.com/AtlasWealthMGMT or just search for Atlas Wealth Management on Facebook. You can also go to our website and that website is www.atlaswealth.com.au and then you can actually subscribe to our newsletter and we'll be sending that out as well too. The next key issue that that was announced that may affect a lot of expats are those expats who have vacant land in Australia. So up until now, what we've seen is people have been trying to claim expenses on key costs of holding that land. But the problem is they haven't actually been earning any income on that land. And what it's been doing is been creating capital losses. So virtually what they're saying now is any expenses associated with holding vacant land will no longer be tax deductible. And this measure is obviously to ensure that no deductions are claimed for vacant land that is not genuinely held for the purposes of earning assessable income. If you own land and you're renting out that space for someone and they're paying you some sort of income or rent, then that's a different story. But for those of you out there who are holding blocks of land with no income coming on that, essentially what's going to happen is those costs will be denied as a tax deduction and it'll actually come off your assets cost basis. So if you bought a piece of land for $100,000 and you've spent $10,000 in council fees, borrowing costs, all sorts of ongoing costs, then that will actually reduce your cost basis on that property when it comes to calculating the capital gains tax. So those are the key issues that obviously that were announced through the federal budget. What I want to do is we're going to throw this out to question time. This is quite often when we get some of the big issues as well that people tend to ask. Look, this can be about what was announced last night, but also too, it can be about key issues that we're going through right now, like the main residence exemption, where we're at with those sort of things. So I'd like to throw the floor open to everyone out there. Let me just stop showing the screen here and I'll just put it back on the webcam so you can see me. Okay. Okay, so Joseph's asked a question. What happened with CGT for non-residents? Joe, is that in relation to property, an investment property, is that correct? Or is that in relation to your own home? Okay, fantastic. So we're at right now, we put up a post about a week ago. It's been the most drawn out piece of legislation we've seen for a very long period of time. As you know, it was announced back in the 2017 budget and submissions opened on the explanatory bill in July. Those submissions closed. It went to the second reading in February in Canberra. And at that point, it was then passed on to the Senate committee. The reason it was passed on the Senate committee was because of the retrospective nature with that legislation. Because it is so far back, we're looking at 9 months going up to 10 months, now we're at 12 months. They were quite concerned by the net that it was gonna catch because even though the legislation wasn't in place, because it was retrospective, then people may have acted on old legislation when in actual fact it was new legislation that was backdated. So we're at right now, unfortunately, the Senate committee recommended for it to be passed through in its entirety, and we're expecting the Senate to vote on that this month. So it's the end is nigh, unfortunately, and if you're an existing expat, Joe, then you will need to certainly consider what you need to do between now and 30th of June 2019, because certainly the rules are very draconian, and you know, we're not considering them remotely fair. Okay, Dean. Okay, that's right, mate. Happy to help. Any other questions in there? Okay, I'll just while actually there's more questions coming in here. So while those questions are coming in, I'll just run through a couple of the key issues we're seeing at the moment for expats, and you know, some of the key topics we're discussing with clients. Obviously, right now the currency is the big one. We're back below 75 cents, which we think is a great thing, due to the interest rate differential between United States and Australia. We've been calling that for a while. We've been getting it wrong for a while when the dollar kept stubbornly going back above 80. But now we're seeing it come back down to fair value. Based on where interest rates are in Australia right now, we expect, you know, the dollar should be around 72 cents. It may get there, it may go below, but right now we see the Australian dollar providing very favourable winds for Australian expats to repatriate wealth and obviously take advantage of the lower dollar, because what we're going to see right now is in the coming years when we do see the Reserve Bank start to lift rates, because from a sovereignty risk point of view, Australia is classified in a very highly favourable nature, overseas investors do love to chase yield. So as soon as we see the Reserve Bank increasing interest rates, then we're going to start to see the Australian dollar creep back up again as well too. The RBA, it would be killing them right now that they haven't actually raised rates back up to their, you know, their nice safe spot, which is 3%. We're still sitting at 1.5% right now, but once that tide turns, it's going to be pretty quick in succession in those rates going up. Okay, next one here from David. CGT legislation discussed regarding principal place of residence only applies to actual versus deemed disposal of property. Spot on. So virtually what the rules mean is if you are overseas, I'm not sure where you are, David, but let's say, for example, you might be in Dubai or Singapore or London, and you were physically in that location when you signed that document, then you are deemed to be overseas when you sold that property. So it's a, you know, you could have lived in a house in anywhere in Australia for the last 20 years and set foot overseas in that first month of that expat posting. If you sign that contract to sell that property, then that's when the new rules kick in. Obviously, if you were to return back to Australia and permanently set yourself up again, and there's always a grey space around how long that's deemed to, you know, take place, but we talk to clients about at least 3 to 6 months. Ideally, you know, if you've got kids, then, you know, getting set up at school, so 3 to 6 months is a pretty conservative assumption, 12 months even better. But if you are permanently resettled back in Australia and were to sell that property, then obviously you don't have to worry about the new rules. But certainly if you are overseas, then that presents a lot of problems too. A question here from Simon. Been an expat for many years and I'm likely to retire overseas in the UK and Ireland. Can you please outline the tax implications re-accessing my Australian superannuation post-retirement? Thanks. The good news is super is agnostic as it pertains to your residency. So the tax status does not change on your super account. And what that means is you have quite a number of choices. The first choice is when you decide you need to start drawing on that capital and you have stopped working overseas, then you can elect to either convert that into an allocated pension, at which point if the balance is below $1.6 million, then you can actually enjoy a tax-free, you know, retirement. Obviously, there's a DTA between, a double taxation agreement between Australia and the UK and Ireland. So there are favourable natures there when it comes to Australian super. The other option as well too is once you are retired, you can actually turn that super fund into an allocated pension, do a whole 100% drawdown of that money and move it back overseas. So it really is a horses for courses type scenario. The good thing is you do have that flexibility. Obviously, when you do decide to go to an allocated pension, there are minimum drawdown requirements. There's no maximum, but there is a minimum, and that starts at 4%. So once you do go through that hoop, you will need to start drawing down 4% of that capital, whether you spend it or not. We have mixed cases of clients. Some like to leave a bit of money in Australia because A, they understand the Australian super scheme, but also B, it's a bit of a currency hedge for them because they are retiring overseas, but they don't know in their later years whether they're going to move back to Australia. So it really is a personal choice when it comes to that. But the good news is you do have a lot of flexibility there. Okay, question for Joe. Are you saying that franking will be reduced to 15%? I've only registered some of my shares as non-residents, so only paying minimal withholding tax but full 30% franking. If I register non-resident, will I end up with some of the money, some of the previously franked tax back in my pocket? Okay, Joe, so there's probably two answers to this question. So when you become an expat, you have what's called deemed disposal. And what that means is, let's say, for example, you owned 1,000 ANZ shares. When you leave the country, you have two choices. You can have deemed to have disposed of it. And what that means is, on paper, you've sold it. And that what that means is you pay the capital gains tax from the time you bought it up until the day that you leave. Now, when you get to that point, then you can either choose to pay that capital gains tax and you do not continue to accrue capital gains tax further on, or you can choose to ignore the deemed disposal rule and you continue to accrue capital gains tax through the remainder of your period overseas. When it comes to the income side, and that's receiving dividends, there's essentially two systems here. So obviously, as we discussed before, there's the non-resident withholding tax, which is between 15 and 30%, or depending on which country you're domiciled in and whether that country has a DTA with Australia. But then you have to look at the underlying investments and how those are derived. So if the dividends are paying with what you've pointed out, which are franking credits, then those franking credits you can use to offset against that non-resident withholding tax. What it means is, if you, and I think this is the question you're alluding to, if you were going from a country that was 30% on non-resident withholding tax back down to 15%, can you get the money back? And the answer is no. I'm guessing that we haven't seen the actual fine details of that because it is forward dated till the 1st of July 2019. So there's still another 12 months to go before we even enjoy that luxury. So between now and then, if you are in a country that does not have double taxation or on that list with Australia, then you'll still be having 30% taken out. But once again, if you have franking credits attaching to those dividends, then that 30% franking credit will take care of the non-resident withholding tax. So it comes down to, you know, you shouldn't be paying, yeah, if all of your dividends are fully franked and they had you down as a non-resident, then you shouldn't be paying any tax at all as far as the non-resident withholding tax is concerned. Okay, so yeah, with the getting some money back in your own pocket, it depends on your circumstances and definitely need to talk to an accountant on that. The reason being is you have two different asset types. You have TARP and non-TARP. And TARP is taxable Australian rural property. And best example of that is an investment unit or a house that you rent out. When you rent that property out, you receive rental income, and that income is classified as Australian sourced income. Now, because of the way that it's structured, the tenant pays the rent to you, and then you then declare to the ATO how much money was paid, as opposed to shares, which are classified as non-TARP, and they're what's called taxed at source. They're not classified as Australian sourced income, and as a result, you don't need to file a tax return for that. So if your circumstances allow it and you might have an investment property, and that's the reason why you do lodge a tax return, then you need to talk to your accountant about whether you can actually back that, any of those sort of things. I think the issue that you need to look at is if you were a non-resident for the last 12 months and you've only changed in the last six, then if you had income from shares that did not have franking credits, then you would have had non-resident withholding tax taken out, or you should have had it. So that's definitely why you need to have a chat to your accountant. So I've never heard anything about deeming. Can you say more about that? Yeah, certainly. So it's essentially what you do when you do your last tax return in Australia. When you leave the country, and this, you may leave the country on the 1st of July, so you wouldn't do this until 30 June the following year. When you lodge your last tax return in Australia before you leave overseas, you can on paper tell your accountant that you would like to have deemed to have disposed of those shares. It doesn't mean you've actually physically gone on to your account and sold those shares. What it means is, on paper, you've sold those shares. So let's say, for example, and we won't use exact numbers, you bought ANZ shares at $20 a share, and when you leave the country, they're $30 a share. So you'll obviously have to pay capital gains tax in that $10. You will get a 50% discount on that because you've held it for longer than 12 months, assuming you have. And then when you go overseas, you are deemed to have disposed of those shares at $30. So you pay that capital gains tax that's due. You still have those ANZ shares and they continue to accrue. And as they accrue, they might go from $30 to $40, but you don't maintain or continue to be having a capital gains tax liability building up because you're a non-resident investor. If you do not pay the capital gains tax at that point of deeming, then even though you're overseas and you're a non-resident investor, you still continue to accrue capital gains tax on that amount. So it's a good idea to go through and run the numbers to see whether it's worthwhile making the jump now in terms of deeming to have disposed of those shares. Once again, you need to chat to your accountant to find out what your options are. But I hope that answers your question there. G'day, Tony in Beijing. If you earn a salary abroad and you pay individual income tax of, say, 15% to the tax office of that country, does the ATO have a claim on you paying tax on the balance at the Australian ATO tax rate? Essentially, what it means, Tony, is if there's a DTA between Australia and, in your case, China, then Australia will recognise and respect the Chinese sovereignty to that tax before you that you pay to them when you declare your return in China. If for some reason you're coming back to Australia, or you know they've got some sort of entitlement on income to you, then the only time we find that the ATO really sort of comes in and says we want more is if you do come back to Australia and you're earning income overseas. So let's say, for example, you move back to Melbourne and on that money you earned in China, China gets the first bite of the cherry. And let's say, for example, it's 15% tax at the equivalent threshold in China, but in Australia, it's 30%. So what will happen is China will levy the 15% first on that income, and then the ATO will levy the next 15% to take it up to the 30%. They won't double tax you. They will only levy the difference between what they think they should charge and what you've already paid to the Chinese bureaus. So as opposed to, say, a country like Dubai, for example, in Dubai, there is no double taxation agreement because there is the potential that if you are living in Australia as a resident earning money in Dubai and you paid money, let's say, for example, Dubai introduced income tax, then the UAE government may take their bite first, as well as the ATO as well too. So that's why it's always important to do your homework to find out whether the jurisdiction you're living in or earning the money in actually has a DTA with Australia. Okay, just while, here we go. After DIEM, yeah, most certainly. So you can have two different scenarios with the DIEMing. And first scenario, like I said, you bought ANZ shares 10 years ago for $20 a share. You move it overseas today. You're obviously getting that dividend income coming through. And then from the day that you move, let's say it's today, for the next 10 years, you're in Singapore, Dubai, London, then you'll still get those dividend coming through. What will happen is when the share registry goes to pay that dividend to your nominated bank account in Australia, or you can have alternatives overseas, but they do cost more. Most clients have their money paid into an Australian account. The share registry will, A, look at your first country of residence. So if your country of residence has a DTA with Australia, then they'll look to take out 15%. The second thing they do is to determine whether there's franking credits attaching to that dividend. If there is, then there's no deduction maintained and 100% of that dividend flows through to you. If they look at the dividend and there's no franking credits, then that's when they will assess either the 15 or the 30% on that. But you'll always get paid that dividend. The only time we've ever seen clients not get paid the dividend is when there's no banking instructions actually held by the registry. Okay, Tony, any information or expectation when the government might increase the 1.6 cap? Yeah, very popular question right now. Essentially, it's based on the indexation of inflation. Right now, inflation is not exactly flying high, so we're not expecting anything anytime soon. They will be in increments of $100,000, so the next jump will be obviously 1.7, but with inflation running at 1.9%, we're not holding our breath anytime soon. But you know, I wouldn't be surprised if even if inflation stayed moderately modest, if we did see an increase in the next couple of years anyway. Okay, Robert here. Hi, I'm Rob in Singapore. Every 3 years I submit a private binding ruling application to the ATO to prove my tax non-residency status. Does the 2018 budget affect this process? Look, we haven't seen anything, Robert, in relation to, changing of the classification process. We did hear last year that the tax board was investigating and probably discussing the just going back to a straight 183-day rule, which everyone would embrace wholeheartedly. Right now, we've obviously got the resides test, the domicile test, and then matching behaviours and all sorts of things, which all it does is it leaves a lot of grey space out there for a lot of expats. Probably the biggest one we find is people on super yachts. You know, they don't actually have a domicile anywhere. Their domicile is the boat, and the boat can be at different marinas at different places around the world. So we would like to see it go back to a 183-day rule. We haven't seen anything at the moment with respect to that classification process. And until we see the tax board really sort of sink their teeth into it, I'm not expecting to see anything changing in the short term anyway. Okay, the other one too we're talking about right now with clients is obviously the banks and the Royal Commission, what our view is of the banks and what our view is on the property market in general. Look, our view as clients who are on the call tonight are all aware we've been very bearish the banks and property for the last 12 months and for reasons that we're seeing coming out to right now. We've seen irresponsible lending practices. We've seen, almost an empire that's been built around the Australian economy in producing property. And by doing that, there's a lot of people out there right now who probably shouldn't be owning property or they should be owning 3 or 4 properties that we've seen. What we're seeing right now is we're seeing an increase in defaults, and those increase in defaults are quite alarming. And the reason being is interest rates have never been as low in Australia since Captain Cook first turned up. So when we do start to see the Reserve Bank increasing those interest rates, then that's going to push up those repayments and put further people into mortgage distress. The other thing we've got as well too, and you might have seen this in the press in the last couple of months, where there's about $540 billion worth of interest-only loans that do have to convert into principal and interest loans over the next 4 years. And that's pretty alarming to us because there's a lot of people out there, once again, who are just getting by on interest-only. So when their repayments go up by 20, 30, 40%, we don't know how they're going to afford to pay for that, and are we going to see some of that profit come off. If the property market wasn't as high, then we wouldn't be as concerned. But we saw an article yesterday in the Financial Review. There's an independent research firm said that Sydney property is 45% overvalued based on global metrics. Now, we all know that Australian property always trades at a higher multiple than, say, US or European property. So I would say 45% is a bit of extreme if you're comparing apples with apples, but at least 10 to 15% overvalued is a pretty safe assumption. And the banks are going to feel the brunt of that. Obviously, people with the large mortgage books like Westpac and also to Commonwealth Bank will probably be the hardest hit. Okay, and the next question we've got here is, where do we see the Australian economy going forward in the next 12 to 18 months? To be honest with you, even though we've got a lot of noise on right now with the Royal Commission and all these things going on, I don't think it'd be pretty safe to say that I think we're in a lot better position than we were 2 years ago. The key litmus test for me is always when we see ASX-listed companies and the CEOs delivering their results, if we see CEOs put their necks on the table and deliver forward guidance, then that to me tells me that that guy's got a fair degree of conviction that it's going to occur. 2 years ago, we did not have any forward-looking statements from hardly any of the companies because corporate Australia did not know how they were going to navigate that space. Now we've seen companies not only come out and last year and forecast 2018 and deliver on that, but we're also seeing them do it again from 2018 to 2019. Obviously, if we are looking at key areas that, like we discussed before with banks and property, we're not exactly enamored in that sector right now and can see further deterioration there. But there's a lot of other sectors that are doing incredibly well in Australia that, we're focusing on for clients right now. Health is one, tech's another. There's also a lot of what we call the old school industrial companies that are, really shooting the lights out overseas. Ansell is a great example of that. People assume or associate answer with the obvious choice, but you know, they're in 40 countries overseas providing supplies to hospitals, medical clinics and those sort of things. And then they're a globally diversified business that, you know, certainly when the dollar comes back in Australia and they repatriate that earnings from overseas back to Australia, that earnings gets an uplift when it comes back to the country as well too. Are there any other questions there at all? I mean, I don't, you know, we're getting pretty close to the hour right now, so I want to make sure that everyone has their chance to have their say. Okay, it doesn't look like there's any more questions coming through there. So, oh, here we go. Robert, you asked a question there on buying shares. Was that a question on how do you do it or tax implications? Yeah, no, look, you know, this is to us one of the greatest or the quietest financial advantages that an expat has when it comes to asset and wealth accumulation. You might remember before I discussed that assets are classified as either TARP, which is taxable Australian real property, house, apartment, mining lease, you know, farm, something you can kick, and then there's non-TARP. And non-TARP assets are shares, managed funds, and ETFs. Now, the benefits of buying shares as a non-resident is the tax rules state that as a non-resident, and it ignores your citizenship for the time being, so it can be Rob based in Singapore or it can be a Chinese national based in Shanghai. If you buy shares, managed funds, or ETFs in Australia, you do not accrue capital gains tax while you're a non-resident. And the reason being is the tax rules surrounding that is designed to attract the massive fund managers like the Templetons, the BlackRocks, you know, the big players that are the big money managers overseas to invest in Australia. And as an expat, you're just fortunate that you can slip under that same rule. It's very different to, say, the tax rules surrounding non-residents buying property. If we saw the Australian government tinker with those rules, you'd see an exodus of cash coming out of the stock exchange, and it wouldn't be a very nice experience at all. So as a non-resident, as a person living overseas, you're able to buy shares in Australia. You do not accrue capital gains tax on those shares whilst you're a non-resident. And then, like we were saying before with Joe, if, you know, when you're looking at the income coming through and you're resident of a country like you are in Singapore from memory, then Singapore has a double taxation with Australia. If the dividends coming through on those shares have franking credits, and I'll discuss what franking credits are in a sec for those who may not be aware, then you can use the franking credit to offset the 15% non-resident withholding tax, and essentially you pay no tax in Australia on that income at all. You'll obviously have to declare it when it comes to your Singaporean tax return, but obviously, once again, there is a DTA between Singapore and Australia. Now, just for those who are unsure what we're talking about with franking credits, I've mentioned it a couple of times now, it's been remiss of me not to explain what they are. And I'll give you a quick 101 on Australian corporate tax. Let's say, for example, ANZ make $1 billion profit. They will give $300 million of that to the ATO by way of corporate tax, and then they'll have $700 million left over to pass on to shareholders by way of a dividend. Now, when that money flows through to the shareholders, the ATO really can't tax it again because it's already taxed that one pool of money first. So because the ANZ has paid tax on that money at 30%, you get a 30% tax credit that you can apply. And obviously, if you're an Australian resident, you can put it against your marginal tax rate. If you're a non-resident, you can put it against your non-resident withholding tax. You can even go to the next level again if you really want it. And this is what we do for clients quite a fair bit in super funds. In super, income's taxed at 15%. Because super's a preserved environment and the franking credit's at 30%, we can use the 30% franking credit to take care of the 15% super income tax. And because it's preserved, the ATO will actually give you a refund back on that unused franking credit. You might have seen in the press in the last month, Bill Shorten raised that as a prospect to stop that. I can go into all the sort of conspiracy theories of why he's doing that. Let's just say it's not the smartest agenda that he's ever put forward, but long story short, we don't see it getting through because of the way that the system's been built. It would have wide scale ramifications to the Australian super scheme, and the only ones who would benefit are the union-backed industry super funds. So, Okay. Any other questions there? Thanks, Simon. Pleasure. Fantastic, guys. I think everyone's pretty much asked what they had asked there. So if you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@atlaswealth.com.au. You can also follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube, and Instagram as well. Just search under Atlas Wealth Management, or ATLASWEALTHMGMT. We do try and produce a lot of our content through social media. We find it's the fastest way we can get it into your hands. And because most people on social media, it's an easy way, an easy interface for us to get that information to you. So once again, thank you so much, guys, for your attendance this afternoon, this evening, and look forward to seeing you next time. Take care.
Thanks for listening. If you found this podcast of value, it would mean the world to us if you could leave a rating and a review, as this will help other Australian expats find the channel and assist them in making the right financial choices as an Australian expat.